Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 45. Krishna rescues his teacher's sons, and we'll read text 39 through 44. So, chant text 39. Tamaha Bhagavan Ashu, Guru Putra Pradiyatam, Yosa Viha Tvaya Grasto, Balako Mahato Tormina, Tamaha Bhagavan Ashu, Guru Putra Pradiyatam, Yosa Viha Tvaya Grasto, Balako Mahatormina, Tamaha Bhagavan Ashu, Guru Putra Pradiyatam, Yosa Viha Tvaya Grasto, Balako Mahatormina. Ladies. To him, Aha said, Bhagavan, the Supreme Lord, Ashu, quickly, Guru of my spiritual master, Putra, the son, Pradiyatam, must be presented, Ya, who, Asau, he, Iha, in this place, Tvaya, by you, Grasta, seized, Balaka, a young boy, Mahata, mighty, Urmina, by your wave. Translation purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada. The Supreme Lord Krishna addressed the Lord of the ocean. Let the son of my guru be presented at once, the one you seized here with your mighty waves. I'll read through the English. Next few verses. The ocean replied, O Lord Krishna, it was not I who abducted him, but a demonic descendant of Diti named Panchajanya, who travels in the water in the form of a conch. Indeed, the ocean said, that demon has taken him away. Hearing this, Lord Krishna entered the ocean, found Panchajanya, and killed him. But the Lord did not find the body within the demon's belly. Lord Janardhan took the conch shell that had grown around the demon's body and went back to the chariot. Then he proceeded to Samyamani, the beloved capital of Yamaraj, the Lord of Death. Upon arriving there with Lord Balaram, he loudly blew his conch shell, And Yamaraj, who keeps the conditioned souls in check, came as soon as he heard the resounding vibration. Yamaraj elaborately worshipped the two lords with great devotion, and then he addressed Lord Krishna, who lives in everyone's heart. O Supreme Lord Vishnu, what shall I do for you and Lord Balaram, who are playing the part of ordinary humans? Purport. The conch shell the Lord took from Panchajana, which is called Panchajanya, is the same one he sounded at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. According to the Acharyas, Panchajana had become a demon in a way similar to that of Jai and Vijay. In other words, though appearing in the form of a demon, he was actually a devotee of the Lord. The Skanda Purana, Avanti Kanda, describes the wonderful things that happened when Lord Krishna sounded his conch shell. Asipatra vanam nama shirna patram ajayata roravam nama narakam aroravam aputtada abhairavam bhairavakyam kumbipakam apachikam. The hell, known as Asipatravana, lost the sharp, sword-like leaves on its trees, and a hell named Rarava became free from its ruru beasts. The Bhairava hell lost its fearfulness, and all the cooking stopped in the Kumbhipaka hell. The Skanda Purana further states, Papa Shatyatata Sarve Vimukta Naraka Nara Adam Avyayam Asadya. Their sinful reactions eradicated. All the inhabitants of hell attained liberation and approached the spiritual world. Om Jnana Timurandasya Gnanjana Salakaya Chaksarun Mintamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakalpa Tugascha Kriba Sindhu Vibacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavyo Namo Namaha. So now we're moving into the story of Krishna's trying to recover the son of his spiritual master, Sandipani Muni. He has approached the ocean. The ocean said, it wasn't I that took him, it was a demon named Panchajana. So Krishna finds this demon Panchajana, very short description here, apparently kills Panchajana, but there is still no sign of the son of their spiritual master. Is it that? And therefore, then Krishna and Balaram go to the abode of Yamaraj to further try to look for the sun, and then we will conclude that in the next few verses. It's a rather interesting story here, and another one of the wonderful pastimes of the Lord. In this particular case, the killing of the Panchajana is interesting because, of course, it is the source of the Panchajanya conch, which we're familiar with even from Bhagavad Gita. It talks about right in the beginning. Krishna blows the Panchajanya conch, and then Arjuna blows Dhiradatta, and so on. So, and it's described in the purport here that this is the same conch, and this is sort of the origin of where Krishna received it. Now, it's kind of, I thought it was kind of interesting that the it's described that the conch shell is the body formed around the demon, and then this somehow becomes a blowing conch shell. There's another description. This whole purport, by the way, is basically almost word for word taken from Vishnudas Chakravarti Thakur's purport, and they quoted extensively from it, including the parts in the Skanda Purana. So I thought I would read another part that Vishwanath talks about this conch shell and sort of how that works. It's a little different interpretation of this. It says the phrase tad anga prabhavam, which is grown from his body, actually means the conch shell was lying in the demon's stomach, according to the Avanti Kanda of the Skanda Purana. Tatak panchajanyam hatva graha rupa mahasuram tad bhajastam sajagraha sankhya grastam hiyapare. Having killed Panchajanya, the great demon in the form of an aquatic, Krishna took the conch which was lying in his belly, tanmajam stam. From this evidence, some acharyas explain the conch was residing within the demon's body, and it merely came out of the demon's body when Krishna killed him. So we have two possible interpretations of the verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam and some other explanation from the Skanda Purana, that perhaps the conch shell was inside the demon. He may have had I don't know if he had a conch shell type of body, but the conch may have been inside him, and that came out when he was killed. Which tends to make a little more sense that then that conch shell would be the appropriate size for Krishna to blow on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. At any rate, that's a detail, probably not terribly important. But I think what was really interesting in this purport and some of this further description from the Skanda Purana was the blowing of the conch shell and what that meant. It's described here that all of the demons in hellish planets became liberated when Krishna blew the Panchajanya conch shell. It's described that they all of the different situations and conditions in hell were ameliorated, and it says their sinful reactions were eradicated. All the inhabitants of hell attained liberation and approached the spiritual world, which is I found this rather interesting. Usually, in the pages of the Bhagavatam and the scriptures, two different things happen when Krishna blows the conch shell. First of all, for the devotees, they find great happiness. They're very elated because this is sort of the sound of victory for Krishna when he blows the conch shell. However, the demons usually are not so happy at the blowing of the conch shell. And in fact, even in the Bhagavad Gita, what was the reaction of the Kauravas when they heard Krishna blowing the Panchajanya? You know, they were fearful. They were disturbed. They thought, oh my, you know, they realized this was the power of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and it was more or less signaling victory. It's almost like just by hearing that conch shell, they knew they were defeated. That was the end at that point. Of course, they all had to go through the next 18 days of battle. But normally, those who are non-devotees are terrified or become very frightened by hearing Krishna's conch. Now, in this particular situation, it's a little bit different because they all became liberated. It sounds like this is the first time that when he had the conch shell and he blows it, all the residents of hell become liberated and freed from all of their sinful reactions. So this is an interesting point about becoming purified and liberated. I thought that also tied in rather nicely with today being the 4th of July, which is Independence Day, right? You know, I'd work it into it somehow here. So the final draft of the Declaration of Independence was actually written on July 2nd. I know this because of my vast knowledge and because I Googled it this morning and found out that, and then it was presented on the 4th of July. It was primarily written by Thomas Jefferson with a lot of edits from all of the people in the congregation and the Constitutional Committee or whatever it was at that time. So on July 4th, they presented this Declaration of Independence, which was quite a unique historic document, because it was proclaiming that they had a right to be independent from England because the country was oppressive, they felt that their liberty was being impinged upon, and therefore they had it was really declaring not just we don't like you and we're taking over, but they had actually a legal, lawful, and even somewhat they invoked God even, that they even had sort of a spiritual or religious right and duty to overthrow the government and to establish a new government, which would give them such things as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, of course, this is fairly common throughout modern history, especially in these last 250 years since this time. We see many liberation movements. We see people always wanting to become liberated. They even call it the something liberation army, right? You know, you have these different names that they use. So this idea of becoming liberated or becoming free is a very, very prominent aspect in our human history, particularly more modern history. People didn't talk so much about freedom and these things before probably the Age of Enlightenment in the mid-1700s. But sort of from that time on, it's been a very prominent historical, political, philosophical theme. Now, of course, we know the reality. This liberation is often very short-lived. This freedom that they're seeking is really not to be found in this material world. We can think of so many examples. Of course, in 1917, we had the Bolshevik Revolution, this great movement to become liberated for royal class, defeating another royal class, but for the common people, the workers, the farmers, to rise up, to actually attain their rightful position and become, free from the oppression of the czars. Well, it wasn't very many years after that we had Joseph Stalin, who murdered Prabhupada, actually said he was one of the biggest demons of all time. He said that at some point, because he killed hundreds of thousands, actually millions of his own countrymen. He had these great purges where he just obliterated anyone he even thought might be any kind of opposition. And there was about 4 million Russians were exiled to Siberia, either never seen again or died or killed there. So, in other words, what became this glorious revolution soon degraded into just more oppression, more suffering for the people. And this is the way things go in the material world. Because there's no real freedom in this material world as long as we are identifying with the body. Because the body is always going to suffer. The body is going to suffer the threefold miseries. It's going to suffer birth, death, disease, and old age. And because of the human tendencies, to try to cheat, to take advantage, the tendency towards to increase one's own sense gratification, people are going to be oppressing one another, cheating one another, and simply not ever providing that real happiness that people are looking for through any political process. So where does real liberation means freedom from sinful reaction and freedom from taking birth again. And that's what Krishna gave all the residents of the hellish planets. When he blew his conch shell, he relieved them of their sinful reactions and gave them liberation so they would not have to take birth again, and they were able to go to Vaikuntha. Liberation is only given by Krishna. Krishna is the source of any freedom from our entanglement within this material world. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.26, Srila Prabhupada says, "The demigods, even to the stage of Brahma, the supreme of all the demigods, cannot offer liberation to anybody. Hiranyakasipu underwent a severe type of penances for becoming eternal in life, but his worshipful deity Brahma could not satisfy him with such blessings. Therefore, Vishnu is called Muktipad, or the personality of Godhead who can bestow upon us mukti, liberation, and no one else can do this." So this is the position of Krishna Muktipad, the one who can give liberation to the conditioned souls. So if we need to be liberated from this material world, it means that we're somehow entangled in this material world. We're caught. We're trapped. We're not free. Why is that? Because we are entrapped or ensnared in a network of sinful activity and reactions to the activity. The sinful activity and its reactions form a network, a cycle that goes on life after life. Through sinful activities, one prepares one's next body. And that next body, one has a particular consciousness which will impel them to further sinful activity, and therefore it goes on life after life. Srila Prabhupada explains this in the Nectar Devotion. He says, sinful activities are of two kinds. This is a little more, we're going to get a little bit into a technical explanation of how sinful reactions work and the cycle of karma. Prabhupada says, sinful activities are of two kinds, those which are mature and those which are not mature. The sinful activities for which we are suffering at the present moment are called mature. We're all familiar with those. Every ache and pain and problem that we experience and anxiety that we experience, these are all our present sinful reactions. The many sinful activities stored within us for which we have not yet suffered are considered immature. Something to look forward to. For example, a man may have committed criminal acts but has not yet been arrested for them. Now, as soon as he is detected, arrest is awaiting him. Similarly, for some of our sinful activities, we are awaiting distresses in the future, and for others which are mature, we are suffering at the present moment. In this way, there's a chain of sinful activities and their concomitant distresses, and the conditioned soul is suffering life after life due to these sins. He is suffering in the present moment, present life, the result of sinful activities in the past life, and meanwhile creating further sufferings for his future life. Mature sinful activities are exhibited if one is suffering from some chronic disease, if one is suffering from some legal implication, or if one is born in a low and degraded family, or if one is uneducated or very ugly. In other words, our current circumstances of life that we find ourselves in, this is our our current reactions or the mature reactions that we are experiencing. Breaking this down a little bit more, Vishnuchakravarti Thakur and some of the Acharyas and Jiva Goswami have explained in Nectar Devotion a little bit how this process of sinful activity works. It says that there are actually three types of suffering. One is the sinful reaction we experience. The second is the seed of sin, the desire seeds that propel us to sinful activity. And three is avidya, or ignorance, the root cause of sinful activity. So sinful reactions are of two kinds, Prabhupada called the mature and immature. The technical words are parabdhama and aparabdham. Parabdham are those that are experienced in this life, and aparabdham are those that are experienced in a future life. A couple other classification, and one's called bija, or seed papas, or sins, that are not yet experienced, but will be in this life. And then there's one called kuti, which is mental impressions of reactions in future life. So I'm not sure exactly what that is, but I was thinking sometimes we may just have some anxiety, or sometimes people have premonition of some suffering or like that. So that's this kuti, sinful, that there's something that we're experiencing, some suffering now that is because of the sinful reaction that we'll experience in the future. And so when one is performing activities, pious activities, or specifically when one is performing bhakti yoga, those sinful activities are destroyed. But they're destroyed in the order of aparabdham, bija, kuti, and parabdham. So in other words, when one takes up devotional service, the first thing that is alleviated is future reactions. And that's it's a great consolation to us conditioned souls, because who knows what future reactions that we have in store for us if we had not taken up devotional service. You know, everything from past lifetimes and our current lifetime that we have committed, those future reactions are dissipated, are dispelled from the practice of devotional service, bhakti yoga, and then the bija and the kuti, the other, and then finally parabdham, which is the current things that we're experiencing. Those are the last sinful reactions to be eradicated through bhakti. So that's the first thing, the sinful reactions that we're experiencing. The second is the seed of sin. And this is really our material desires. These are the desires within the heart. Now, in the sixth canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the first three chapters, the story of Ajamil, and then the conversations with the Yamadutas, and then Yamaraj's discussions with the Yamadutas. It's a very, very wonderful part of the Srimad Bhagavatam that really explains this whole process. And one of the themes there is given, and actually it's Maharaj Parikit's original question to Shukadeva Goswami. He says, why is it that we see that people may become, they may atone, they may become free from their sinful activities, they may change, but they go back to them? And he gave the example of the elephant bathing, right? Very familiar example that we've all heard. That the elephant takes a bath, it sprays water all over itself, gets out of the river, and what does it do? Rolls in the dust and gets dirty again. I think I mentioned this before, but I actually at a zoo, I was watching the elephants to see, and they do, this is exactly what they do. I confirmed it by my personal experience. They get all clean, they go and roll in the dust. You know, and I think there's some reason they do that. I think there's something, it's actually good for them. I don't know, they close the pores or something. I don't know what it is. But anyway, do you know what that is? What is it? Talc powder. Okay, so they're powdering themselves after bathing. Thank you. Okay, so at any rate, but this is what happens, and that is the analogy we have to people, the sin and confess idea that the Christians have. You know, I commit sins all week, I go to confession, they're absolved, and I go back and commit more sins. So the sinning, confessing, or in a more of a other context, say more of a Hindu context, that one does some, you know, pious activity, some atonement, some purification process, and then immediately one takes up sinful activity again. So this really doesn't work. And so we continue to experience this entanglement in the material world and continued reaction as long as the material desire is still within our heart to commit these activities. And that material desire comes from avidya, or ignorance. And ignorance is considered to be its own source of suffering, because avidya is both the cause and the result of suffering. Because of avidya, which means not knowing that we are spirit, soul, eternal servant of Krishna, we commit sinful activity. And then through commission of sinful activity, our ignorance increases. we become more and more covered over by the material energy and less understanding of our real spiritual nature. So in that way, it's both the cause and the result of further suffering. So fortunately, this desire for sin, not just the sinful activity can be absolved, the reaction can be absolved, but the actual desire for sinful activity, which propels further sinful activity, can be absolved through the process of bhakti yoga. And this is all really nice explaining the story of Ajamil. I'm going to read one verse in part of a purport for Srila Prabhupada. This is 6.2.17. The verse is, although when they neutralize the reactions of sinful life through austerity, charity, vows, and other such methods, these pious activities cannot uproot the material desire in one's heart. However, if one serves the lotus feet of the personality of Godhead, he is immediately free from all such contamination. Srila Prabhupada says, devotional service is so powerful that one who performs devotional service is immediately freed from all sinful desires. All desires within this material world are sinful, because material desire means sense gratification, which is always involves action that is more or less sinful. Pure bhakti, however, is anyavilashita shunya. In other words, it is free from material desires which result from karma and jnana. One who is situated in devotional service no longer has material desires, and therefore he is beyond sinful life. Now, there's a key word here I noted, which was pure bhakti. So what about us who may not yet be established in the position of pure bhakti? What hope is there for us? All right, a pure devotee obviously is completely free from material desires, but what about us who are perhaps a little more conditioned in this material world? The answer is, again, from the Nectar of Devotion. The Nectar of Devotion talks about six characteristics of pure devotional service. The first is immediate relief of distress. And the others are, it awards auspiciousness, disregard for liberation, it's rarely attained, it gives transcendental pleasure, and has the ability to attract Krishna. But our acharyas explain that these qualities are progressive as we advance in Krishna consciousness. The first two are there at the stage of sadhana, the second two at the stage of bhava, and the last two at the stage of prema. So at the stage of sadhana, the first two characteristics, immediate relief of distress and all auspiciousness, are there. So even for the beginning devotee, that immediate relief of distress is given. Now, so bhakti yoga can alleviate that suffering that we experience from past sinful reactions, even in our beginning stage, as soon as we take up the order of the spiritual master. Now, one says, hey, well, what does immediate mean? Maybe I have taken up devotional service and I don't feel necessarily like immediate total relief of all suffering. I think it's either Vishnu or Jiva Goswami explains this word immediate. And he gave this example. It says, if you have a stack of leaves, palm leaves or something, you have a stack of leaves and you put a needle through it, you can say it has immediately gone through the stack of leaves. But actually, if you sort of put it in slow motion, I don't think the Acharya said this, I don't think they had slow motion those days. But if you slowed it down, you would see it actually going through one, then the other, and the other, and the other. So in one sense, it seems like it's an immediate action, but in another sense, it's progressively going through one leaf after the other. So that's, they said, the sense of immediate. It means very quickly, as compared to hundreds of lifetimes that we would have to experience. So very quickly, maybe just this lifetime. Maybe it'll be this one lifetime that we have to sort of, you know, work through all of these sinful activities and have them alleviated one by one. So in that sense, it's very quickly. And this immediate relief is given at the stage of sadhana. So bhakti yoga is a very, very positive process. There's great hope in bhakti because we are assured by the scriptures that these sinful reactions will be alleviated. We will experience the purity of devotional service in time. Now, we have to also mention what is the best path to reach the stage of purification and liberation. It's obviously in this Kali Yuga through the chanting of the holy name. And there are many, many, many references to this. I'll just read a couple ones from the Bhagavatam. 5.25.11. Even if he be distressed or degraded, any person who chants the holy name of the Lord, having heard it from the bona fide spiritual master, is immediately purified. Even if he chants the Lord's name jokingly or by chance, he and anyone who hears him are freed from all sins. It's pretty powerful, the holy name. 627, again, story of Ajamil. Ajamil had already atoned for all of his sinful actions. Indeed, he has atoned not only for his sins performed in one life, but for those performed in millions of lives, who are in a helpless condition, and that's explained, that means without offense. That's an important ingredient here, but we don't have time to talk about offenses today. But in a helpless condition, he chanted the holy name of Narayan. Even though he did not chant purely, he chanted without offense, and therefore he is now pure and eligible for liberation. This is the power of the holy name. That even if it is chanted not in the pure state, but just in a non-offensive state, it has this power of liberation. So we can hardly estimate the power of the holy name that can actually free us from all of these sinful reactions. And particularly, of course, when the holy name is given by the bona fide spiritual master, when it comes in the line of parampara, as Srila Prabhupada has given us this Hare Krishna mantra. And that is why he's so much emphasized, is chant Hare Krishna. And we are the Hare Krishna movement. Because there's that power in the holy name, you know, to actually relieve all of the suffering of the living entities. Now, I knew as I presented this that someone's going to say, yes, but is that what we're, you know, aren't devotees on a higher level than just looking for liberation? Yes. So, the benefits of chanting the holy name far exceed even liberation or freedom from sinful life. And of course, one of our best examples and discussions of that is the story of Haridas Thakur in the Anchalila, third chapter of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Just read a few of those verses. Haridas Thakur says, some say that by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one is freed from all the reactions of sinful life. And others say that by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one attains liberation from material bondage. So that's true, we've established that. Haridas, however, said that the desired resulting of chanting the holy name of the Lord is not that one is liberated from material bondage or freed from the reaction of sinful life. The actual result of chanting the holy name of the Lord is that one awakens his dormant Krishna consciousness, his loving service to the Lord. Haridas Thakur said that liberation and freedom from the reactions of sinful activities are only byproducts of the chanting of the holy name. Haridas Thakur said that as the sun begins to rise, it dissipates the darkness of light, even before the sun is visible. Before the sunrise even takes place, the light of dawn destroys the fears and dangers of night, such as disturbances by thieves, ghosts, and rakshasas. And when the sunshine actually appears, one engages in his duties. Similarly, even before one's chanting the holy name is pure, one is free from all sinful reactions, and when he chants purely, he becomes a lover of Krishna. A devotee never accepts mukti, even if Krishna offers it. Mukti, freedom from all sinful reactions, is obtained even by namabhasa, or the glimpse of the light of the holy name before its full light is perfectly visible. So again, confirming that even before the stage of pure chanting, in this connection, we're discussing the intermediate stage or namabhasa stage, which is considered like the glimmering of the whole nectar and the whole power of the holy name is there. When it's not on a pure stage, but this namabhasa is the middle stage between the offensive and the offenseless stage. So this in this namabhasa stage or intermediate stage of chanting, when one is chanting sincerely, although maybe not completely purely, at that stage, Haridas Thakur is saying that pure love of God will arise and that liberation and freedom from sinful reactions is simply a byproduct of the power of the chanting of that holy name. So, very, very important process, and we can understand how this liberation comes about and how the devotee even goes far exceeding the platform of liberation, eventually to the platform of pure devotional service and pure love of God and experiences that loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I want to conclude by going back to the Declaration of Independence. We'll conclude our 4th of July class today. The most famous line in the Declaration of Independence probably is this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator, at least they mention God, with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So this is what was considered to be the most important things. I had heard once, though, that originally it was written pursuit of property, and they changed that to pursuit of happiness. This kind of really shows where they were really at. But so, life. Krishna gives us eternal life. Life is not about the life we experience in this material world, in these material bodies. So real life is given by Krishna, the life of the soul and the soul's relationship with God. Liberty, we've talked about that. Krishna awards that liberty, real freedom, freedom from rebirth in this material world, freedom from the suffering in this material world. And that's the natural freedom of the soul in relation with Krishna. They talk about these being inalienable rights, that they are self-evident, they are endowed by the Creator. Yes, yes, these are. Our natural position is to become free of this material world, to have eternal life and pursuit of happiness. Yes, our real position is to be happy. Krishna gives us real happiness, and real happiness is found in bhakti, in the soul's relationship of service and love with God. When we are in that relationship with Krishna, when we are serving Him, when we are in our constitutional position, then the true pursuit of happiness is fulfilled. So, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. So, any questions or comments?
Yes, Prabhupada, very nice class. In a 1944 BTG article, Prabhupada, in his commentary on this verse that describes the aparabdha kutam bijam and parabdha karma. And then he says how pure devotional service destroys all aspects of this. And then he makes an interesting point. He says it appears that this takes place gradually, but actually it takes place all at once. And then he says, then he gives a famous analogy of the unplugging of the fan.
Yeah.
So I had a dialogue with Gopi Prantan about, well, when is the fan actually unplugged? And how is it that... Okay, so then the conclusion was that it takes place at the beginning or when one initiates the process of Uttama Bhakti.
Under the order of the spiritual master. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, therefore, you know, that's the first characteristic of pure devotional service, kleshagni, you know, the eradication of distress or of suffering. So then the obvious question is, why is it that devotees still go through all this stuff? Is it because they're not practicing Uttama Bhakti? Or maybe they are practicing Uttama Bhakti. And then there's a question that arises from Sarvadharman Pripchagja Mamikam Sharanam Vraja. You know, so Krishna promises if we simply surrender to him, take up Uttama Bhakti, that it'll eradicate all sins. So then, in a 1992 Nectar Devotion course, Gary Raj Swami kind of clarifies this by quoting Prabhupada as saying that when one takes up pure devotional service, then Krishna takes charge of his sinful reaction, of these sinful reactions. It's like he moves it from the devotee's account, puts it in his own account, and uses those sinful reactions to help the devotee advance. And therefore, it kind of makes sense, this whole, you know, 10.14.8, tat te nukam pam shukshamikshamano, where in that purport, Gopi Prandan makes a point, you know, karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajan, you know, that when one takes up devotional service, he's no longer under the laws of karma. So anyway, I thought I'd throw those points in, you know, kind of stir things up a little bit.
Thank you. Other comments or questions? Pardon, Govinda?
In chapter 69 verse, Prabhupada puts similar in a little more dramatic, I would say. He says, Abrajyobha Bhasate, Krishna consciousness means constant association of with Krishna in such a state of mind that one can observe the material cosmic manifestation as Krishna does, although it is not all time possible or visible. In the end of the Parabrahma, Prabhupada writes that sometimes devotees, when they join, they pray to Krishna, I want to go back home, I want to be engaged in devotional service. But then Krishna looks at his heart, this soul wants so many desire he has, and he has emotional attachment. Then Prabhupada writes that Krishna will throw and destroy all those, but giving in a token. So then Prabhupada gives in the next sloka of Prabhupada that if devotee needs hundreds of life to fulfill all his desire, and he wants to go back home next life, Krishna has to put all these hundreds of life desire into one life. So sometimes devotee may experience is like a very strange in a dream or practical that so many things comes in life that never even karmi does not experience. But one should understand that Krishna is so merciful that he is giving the entire 100 lives in a little token form. So then soul asks at that time that I don't want any more. Please, my Lord, please engage me. I want to go back home. That's how Krishna purifies all these desires that stored in the heart.
Thank you. Could you give, what was the source? What purport
was that? 4th canto, 29 chapter, 69 verse, and few verses.
429, 69 in that area? Okay, I like to look at that. It's very good. Thank you. Okay, other thoughts, comments? Go ahead, Dharmaraj.
I don't mean to stray from topic, but in the beginning of your class, you mentioned about the apparent contradiction of the Panchajanya Kaṅśa. I just want to mention that these pastimes and itihasas as described by different acharyas and devotees, they don't always relate to the most recent appearance of Lord Krishna on this planet. Sometimes it's from previous pastimes, so the same pastime that Lord Krishna performed elsewhere. Like, for example, in the Gopal Champu by Srila Jiva Goswami, you might get a different explanation there also, because that's all based on his dialogue and the spiritual. So sometimes these pastimes might be apparently different details, but one understanding is that it's all.
That's a nice explanation. I think the Skanda Purana is very old, isn't it? I mean, well, all the Puranas are very old, but. And sometimes they do talk about different incidents and different yugas, different appearances. That's true. In other words, I maybe shouldn't even have brought that up. I mean, it's not that there's one's right or one's wrong, but sometimes there are different interpretations or a little different different takes on the pastimes by the different acharyas. And sometimes it's even mentioned. Sometimes you'll read in one purport that this acharya says it could be this way and this acharya says it might be that way. It's not that either of them are wrong. It's either a different emphasis, or as you were stating, it could even be that it was a little bit different pastime that was performed in a different way, at a different time, at a different appearance like that. So, yeah, these things are not contradictions in a sense, and our acharyas are all giving us the absolute truth. And, yeah, we just have to try to kind of take it all in and understand the best we can. Yeah. Madam Mahaprabhu?
Two verses came also to my mind. It's like... I think it's, 3:5, Bhagavad Gita, that everyone is forced to act helplessly by the modes of nature that they're involved with. But when one gets Krishna consciousness, he's not forced anymore. He's been liberated from that force because he has devotional service he's desiring to do. And with that same verse, 4:29, 69, Rahu's mentioned in that verse. He says, you can't see that planet, but it becomes visible. When does Rahu become visible?
During an eclipse.
During an eclipse. So it explains that when you have the knowledge of devotional service, then you can see material desires, not so much one by one, but you can see them as the whole group of what material desires are in principle. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of deal with it wholesale. You know, in other words, I once asked a person, are you in distress because you're not fulfilling your material desire, or are you in distress because you have a material desire? You know, using this as the impetus for that idea is that all material desires are distressful, whether you fulfill them or you don't fulfill them. So it's like a vijñan stage where you see.
Yeah, that was sort of the idea of avidya or ignorance, that it in itself is distressful. It's not only the source, but it actually, you experience distress from sinful desires, material desires themselves. Okay, we should probably, anything else? We should probably end at this point. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.